I'm Kathy with a K.
And I'm Kathy with a C.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is Pleasanton, California. Incorporated in 1894 with a current population of almost 80,000 residents, today the city is an upscale suburb of the San Francisco Bay Area. The history of Pleasanton was largely shaped by its geographic location along the first transcontinental railroad. Ranchers and thoroughbred horse breeders were attracted to the favorable climate and abundance of water and were soon followed by dairy farms, hop fields, and vineyards. Today, Pleasanton enjoys a rich blend of historic turn-of-the-century charm and a high quality of life and economic well-being desired by both residents and businesses. It has been named one of the best places to live in California, with a very low crime rate, high average income of $186,000 a year, and its status as a center for commerce and technology. But in 2008, two of Pleasanton's affluent residents learned that high-end living and a low crime rate can't protect you from a killer.
It was March of 2008 when the Scherer children, 29-year-old Ernest III and 24-year-old Catherine, along with family and friends, gathered to say goodbye to their parents, Ernest and Charlene. Ernest was only 60 at the time of his death, and while he started out his career as an accountant, he made a lot of money as a real estate investor. And he was also involved in politics. In the 1980s, he was a member of the San Ramon School Board. And San Ramon is the place where he and his wife Charlene originally raised their children. And they had moved to Pleasanton 2 years before their death. Now, Charlene was only 57 at the time of her death, and she was a professor. She spent 31 years, I think it was, as a professor at Cal State East Bay teaching accounting. She was also a devout Mormon. She worked very hard and tried to instill her values in her children as she was raising them. What made this funeral even more tragic was the way Ernest and Charlene had died. They were victims of homicide, and at the time of their funeral, there were no suspects in the case, and no one had any idea why anybody would want these two wonderful people dead. The grisly discovery of Ernest and Charlene took place a week before the funeral. The Scherer parents were in the middle of planning a Hawaii trip, and they were inviting each of their children and their grandchildren to join them in Hawaii. And Catherine lived in Utah. Ernie lived in Southern California in a town called Brea. And they didn't get to spend as much time with their parents as they all would have liked. So as the trip approached, Catherine tried getting in touch with her parents to solidify plans and nail everything down, but no one answered when she called. So when this happened a number of times, Catherine got worried. And so now we're in mid-March of 2008. Catherine called the Castlewood Country Club where her parents lived. They had a home right on the golf course, were members of the country club, and were generally well-known in the community. Catherine asked one of the employees to go to her parents' house and check on them. And when he did, he knocked on the door and there was no answer. So they started walking the perimeter of the property and looked in a window when they saw Ernest lying face down in a pool of blood. Immediately, 911 was called.
According to court records, when first responders arrived, the first thing they did when they entered the house was they noticed the smell of decay. Both Charlene and Ernest were in their pajamas, and it looked like they had suffered from blunt force trauma to their heads, as well as stab wounds all over their body. So the first thing the detectives needed to do was figure out when the Scherer parents had died. So they set about looking at the newspapers, and they looked at their mail and at videos from the entrance and exit gates for the country club. And what they found was that on the night of March 7th, this was the very last time they were seen in public. They'd had dinner at the country club and were seen on video surveillance leaving the country club. And March 7th was also the last time they'd picked up their newspaper. The medical examiner determined they had been bludgeoned and stabbed in their heads, upper bodies, and their throats and wrists had been slit as well. The forensic pathologist, however, could not tell which of the couple was attacked first, but they did come close to confirming the March 7th date because they said by the time they had a chance to do the autopsy, the Scherers had been dead for 12 days, and they got bodies about a week after they were taken to the morgue. Now, Kath, breaking it down, Ernest had 6 blunt force injuries and 6 stab wounds. Mom Charlene had 20 blunt force injuries and 12 stab wounds.
Kath, do you know if the coroner was able to determine if they were stabbed first or hit first?
Not that it was ever reported where I saw.
So we don't know if they died from trauma or blood loss.
And the challenge with it is that sometimes California is the hardest one to get court records on, but there was nothing I saw published by the state or in anything else I read or saw in video that they had actually made that determination. When the detectives talked to the 2 Scherer children, they both said they had no idea as to who would want to kill their parents. As Kathy said, they were very involved in the community, known by many. They had a very close circle of friends and had what was described as a very loving marriage. Bloody footprints were found near the bodies and throughout the house. The house, actually, Kath, had been turned upside down and ransacked, but to the trained investigative eye, they realized that there were a lot of valuables still left in the house. And then one of the places the bloody footprints led was to a linen closet. Now, unlike the rest of the house that really had been kind of torn apart, the linen closet had been picked through as if somebody might have known something was being hidden there or something like that, and they didn't have to just pull everything out at once. However, they did quickly rule out the possibility that Charlene had been the target of the murder because she was very well liked and very well respected at her job at Cal State East Bay, both by colleagues and students alike. She also was active in her church, she volunteered at nonprofit organizations, and she loved birdwatching. Ernest, however, was a different story. There were several aspects of his life that stood out to police as being a potential flashpoint for any harm that might come to him. Police learned that Ernest Scherer was an avid recreational gambler, loved to play poker, would go to the casinos as often as he could, had poker games, not at his house because Mormon wife Charlene did not approve. She would not allow the gambling nor the drinking in their house. But it also turned out, according to Ernest's friends, that he liked to brag about how much he was winning and flash a wad of cash.
I think being a poker player would be very difficult.
Oh, like, absolutely.
My son loves poker, and he used to be in like a Sunday night poker thing when he lived at his old place, but he's very conservative by nature. So once he started losing, he was done.
Do you remember when we went to the Best Lake a few years ago, we all started playing poker? Oh, he was leading us all in poker?
Yes. And I try to bluff and I'm terrible.
Yeah,
I'm like, I could not play poker.
He's really good at bluffing.
Yeah.
You can't read his face.
My brother's a good poker player too. My mom loved playing poker. Many of my childhood memories involved being awakened late at night by my parents and their friends, ha ha ha, yucking it up in the, you know, in the kitchen. And then if I had to come in to like get a glass of water, they'd be like, go to bed. Like, poker chips the next day when I woke up were all over the table. And yeah, they totally loved playing like penny poker.
Detectives uncovered that the morning that Ernest died, he had actually won big at a local casino, which of course led them to think, did somebody see him win? Was he flashing his cash and causing a scene? And did they follow him home and do kind of a home invasion to get this money? That was kind of their working theory until they had a chance to go in and look at the bedroom. And on the bedroom floor was a pair of men's jeans that had $100 bills sticking out of the pockets and obviously hadn't been taken. So if somebody was looking for cash, they missed it.
They weren't looking very hard.
Exactly. And so crime scene techs actually gathered up all the money and it totaled $9,000. And that was the exact amount that Ernest had won in poker that morning. But of course, now to detectives, this also ruled out the possibility that Ernest and Charlene were the targets of a home invasion.
So the detectives kept digging into Ernest's history. And as we said earlier, he was on the San Ramon School Board in the 1980s. Well, in 1990, now this is 18 years prior to the murders, Ernest and a friend were recalled in an election, and it was reported that they were recalled because they refused to negotiate when the teachers' union went on strike. So Ernest was a fiscal conservative, and he did not like how much power the teachers' union had, and he was a very outspoken critic. He was very critical of the waste and the spending, and generally an outspoken adversary of the school board that he once served on. And I think he felt he knew so much because he had once been part of it.
Right.
You know, so he had seen behind the veil.
Exactly. And his biggest complaint was that he believed that some of the things that the school board was done, because he believed the power the teachers union had was over the school board itself. So there were some measures that they had put through to get more funding. And Ernest believed it was a ruse to actually increase teacher salaries without saying that they were increasing teacher salaries.
Right. And he was scheduled to have a meeting with a friend and a political ally just a few days before he was found beaten to death. And what Ernest was alleging was that there was corruption on the school board. So the person with whom he was scheduled to meet was a former San Ramon mayor. And detectives meet with this guy, and he tells them that Ernest had reams of documents which were designed to prove that numbers had been manipulated regarding a bond measure that had passed 4 years prior. That's the one that Ernest was saying, hey, it was only designed to line people's pockets, the numbers are fake, and I'm going to blow the lid off this thing. So this was not the first time that Ernest had challenged the validity of a ballot measure.
Specifically by the school board.
Correct. Nor was it the first time that he accused board members of malfeasance. However, going through all of the reams of paper, looking through all of the players and all of this, the detectives could not come up with any realistic suspect whom they believed would have gone so far as to murder Ernest and his wife. So with the outside players, his friends and political foes, not panning out, detectives then had to go to the most obvious suspects, his children, because it was estimated at the time of Charlene and Ernest's death that each of their children stood to inherit $2 million apiece.
Just under $2
million. Just under $2 million.
Yeah, there was a point of contention in the newspapers at the time because somebody had said over $2 million, and the Pleasanton Weekly said, it wasn't over $2 million. It was under $2 million. And it's like, you know, potato, potato. I'll take either.
Still a lot of cheddar.
Yeah, exactly.
So the police were able to quickly eliminate Catherine. As we said, she lived in Utah, and she was able to immediately prove that she was home in Utah on the night of the murders. They also looked at her cell phone data. Nobody suspicious was called. There was no indication in any way that she would have hired anybody to do this. So this left son Ernie. Ernie was married to his wife, Robin, and the two met at BYU. And like many young couples at BYU, they married shortly after graduation from college. They had a young son together. I want to say he was only like 2 or 3 at the time of his grandparents' murder. Okay. And so they all lived together in Southern California in Brea. Although Ernie had a degree in economics, he also followed in his father's footsteps by loving poker. But he took it to the next level and he decided, I'm going to drop everything else and I am going to become a professional poker player. So he dedicated all of his time to it, and he actually succeeded in becoming a professional poker player, and his wife, Robin, supported that endeavor. And it was reported that at the height of his gambling career, he made more than $100,000, and he even played in the World Series of Poker. But since his income was hit and miss, as you can imagine, he could not get a loan to buy a house. So when Robin and Ernie found a home in Brea, I want to say it was over $600,000. They put 20% down, but the seller carried 10%, and his father had to give him a loan for the rest, which the loan was over $600,000.
Yeah, 616.
Okay. And so he paid his father what he otherwise would pay in a mortgage every single month.
But it was a 5-year loan. It was not a 30-year loan.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
But he was paying over $5,000 a month to his dad.
Almost five. Not just to his dad. He still had the 10% that he owed to the seller.
And so there must have been...
But it was around $4,600. So most of it obviously was to his dad.
There must have been a balloon payment to his dad coming up.
I'm sure there was.
But anyway, so when detectives really began focusing in on Ernie, they recalled that after the parents' murder, after he was notified that his mom and dad had been killed and he came to their home, which was the then scene of the crime, one of the first things he wanted to do was see their will. He insisted on seeing their will. That naturally raised suspicions.
So Ernie agreed to be questioned by the police and talked to them about the night his parents were killed. He said that he was in Brea asleep. His wife and child happened to be on vacation with her family, so they weren't there, but said, "I'm sure my cell phone can prove that I was there." But detectives were kind of pressing him. "Okay, you may not have done it, but did you have anything to do with your parents' deaths?" And he insisted, "No, no, no. Why would I want my parents killed? My dad was my best friend. Why would I ever have something like that happen?" But just a week after speaking with Ernie, investigators were going through video from the country club. And in this video, they noticed in the wee hours of the night, a red convertible Camaro that had a black top that looked familiar to them, because it was the exact same car that Ernie Scherer drove. Looking at this videotape, they see that the car entered the Castlewood property at 8:27 p.m. on the night of the murders, and it left 4 hours later. Police reached out to Ernie again. Now that they have this information, they want to have another conversation with him. And when they spoke to Ernie's wife, Robin, they learned he dipped.
Mm-hmm.
So detectives talked to his wife, Robin, and she told them that when he left, he told her the reason he was leaving was he had to be alone to grieve. She said, "When are you coming home?" And he said, "I'll be in touch."
And didn't tell her where he was going.
Yeah, exactly. Leaving, again, a three-year-old son at home.
Mm-hmm.
When he left home, though, he wasn't driving his red Camaro. He actually was driving one of his dad's cars. So the red Camaro was in the driveway.
See, he had flown to Pleasanton when he found out his parents were murdered and had simply took his dad's car home with him.
Right. Because the car was still there, detectives used the opportunity to get a search warrant for the car, and they found nothing. But then they found a receipt that showed that the day after the murders, Ernie had taken his car to a local car wash and got it detailed inside and out. Really, there was nothing there to find. So with no trace of evidence in the car, the cops now pored over crime scene photos to see, is there any clue we missed? Is there something we need to know? And they started with the bloody footprints. The ones they found on the carpet from Charlene to Ernest to the linen closet. But one of the places they found them also was on the tile floor of the entryway. The interesting thing was, when they saw the footprints on the tile floor, they said that they looked like they'd been staged because the print itself was perfect. It looked like it had been very carefully rolled onto the tile floor to make sure you knew the make and model of the shoe as well as the size. And it was a size 12 Nike. So investigators really were of the opinion that these footprints were not real. It was trying to make them believe that somebody with a size 12 foot had actually killed the Scherer parents, when in fact it was somebody who had a different shoe size than that. But then there was another interesting fact that came to their attention. Remember, we talked about the footprints that had gone from Charlene to Ernie to the linen closet, and that it looked like somebody had not ransacked the closet, but rather went through it. After Ernie dipped, of course, Robin starts going through all these things in her head. The fact that the police were doing a search warrant on the car that he drove. She didn't know where he was that night. And she remembered a conversation she had with Ernie at his parents' house right after they found out they had been murdered. According to Robin, when the family was finally allowed inside the parents' home, Ernie led her straight to the linen closet. And when they got there, he reached in and he pulled out a decorative sword, one that he said his father had brought back from Turkey a few years prior. But there had been two swords, and there was only one in there at that time. And so he showed it to her and, you know, wanted her to admire it and whatnot. But Robin said she remembered as Ernie was putting it back in the closet, he muttered something under his breath that sounded like, "Gee, I wonder where the second sword went." When Robin realized what that could have meant, she called the detectives and told them exactly everything she remembered, right down to the tone of voice and walking directly there and whatnot, because she was now afraid her husband was a killer.
I am sure she was bitter because he left, you know, and he was roaming around and she was hanging out with a three-year-old, not having any idea where he was or what he was doing or when he was coming home.
Exactly. Or where was she getting their next dollar from?
For sure.
Despite Ernie now being a main suspect, detectives obviously didn't have enough evidence to arrest him. They decided to watch him and hoped he would make a mistake.
Remember those endless summer days that felt like they just last forever? Sun rays kiss your skin. Grass tickles your toes as you bite into the creamy popsicle melting in your hand. Pure, unbothered bliss. Capture more sun-drenched memories with the Orange Vanilla Dream Hydration Multiplier from Liquid IV. This nostalgic vanilla flavor with notes of candied orange can help keep you hydrated while savoring your favorite golden hour moments. No matter how hot your summer gets, just one stick of Liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than water alone. It's three times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, with 8 vitamins and nutrients for refreshing on-the-go hydration. Live your summer dream with Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code INDULGE20 at checkout. That's code INDULGE20 at liquidiv.com.
When Ernie decided to make poker playing his profession, his mother, Charlene, was very critical. And being a Mormon, she did not appreciate his chosen profession and believed
his
it would
wanton
only,
ways.
Exactly. Believed it would only lead to trouble. And of course, she was correct. Ernie's sister, Catherine, quoted Charlene, because Charlene, again, was very critical of the poker playing. And she said, "You can't be a professional gambler. That's like saying I'm a professional nose picker."
I know a couple kids who could be.
Oh, my God. Same. Anyway, so detectives kept an eye on Ernie.
Otherwise known as the professional nose picker.
Exactly. And as he traveled the country playing poker tournaments, they discovered that he was posting ads on Craigslist everywhere he went looking for women. So this is one of the ads. "I am 6 foot tall, a non-smoker. I am really just looking for someone that is intelligent and can hold an interesting conversation over a glass of wine. Maybe you are here from out of town for a convention. We can get together for drinks and listen to some live music. If we hit it off, maybe we can have dinner. I know Las Vegas and have lots of great places to go to and things to do. If you're a non-smoker, college educated, HWP, and between the ages of 25 and 40, here's my number." So Kathy and I had to look up what HWP was.
Exactly. Is that like single white, SWF, single white female?
Yeah. And
no.
What was it? I can't even remember.
It was height, weight, proportionate.
Exactly.
Meaning no fatties need apply.
Yeah. Don't be too skinny. Don't be too fat.
No, it wasn't even don't be too skinny. What I read said that's what height, weight, proportionate means. But basically everything I read said, don't be overweight. Don't be too fat. Like blah, 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 blah. They don't care if they're too skinny.
Yeah. But it's like when I read this, it's like, oh my God, I don't believe a word that, like when he says, just looking for someone that is intelligent and can hold an interesting conversation over a glass of wine. Obviously, he was trying to like have women go, oh, what a lovely man.
What a romantic.
Oh my God.
I'm so lucky.
This totally reminds me. I had I shouldn't say he was my friend. He was my brother's friend. And they'd been friends since like back in the day. This man was like, he was funny to talk to, but I'm 100% certain he was a sociopath. And again, he's entertaining, but he's the kind of guy you have to keep at an arm's distance. He used to post ads that said, oh my God, widower fireman looking for a woman who loves long walks on the beach and dogs. And I mean, all this crap. And he wasn't a fireman. He wasn't a widower. But oh my God, the people that responded to his ads were ridiculous. And he went on a date. This is so terrible. And yet I'm so freaking amused by it. But he went on a date and he could tell it was not going well. So the girl gets up to go to the bathroom and he looks in her purse while she's gone. I don't hear this from him. I hear this through my brother.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So she gets back and she's like, okay, well, you know what? I don't think this is working out. I think I'm going to go. And he goes, well, let's split the check. And she goes, I don't have any money. And he goes, yes, you do.
Oh.
Can you imagine?
No.
Anyway, she stormed out.
I was going to say, did she clock him upside the head?
I know.
With her purse
I would have been like, peace out, buddy. You can do dishes for my portion of the meal.
Exactly.
In speaking with some of the women that Ernie met through Craigslist, the detectives learned that he had this fake identity. He called himself Bill Franks. And detectives actually sought out some of these women. And with one of them, she said that he told her that he was writing a novel about a professional poker player whose parents were murdered, and therefore this poker player had to go on the lam. And, you know, a little too close for comfort for the detectives.
Right.
But this, the woman who he was dating had no idea that he was a poker player.
Right, exactly.
She just thought like, oh, he's this
just
very
a Joe Schmo.
Creative man.
He probably said he was from a convention. He was there for a convention.
Exactly. Exactly.
Vegas is lousy with him.
And there was another woman they found with whom he had two dates, mm-hmm. I believe. And so one of the dates was broken and Ernie said, I'm sorry, I can't go out with you tonight. My parents' house was broken into and both of them were murdered. And when they checked his call logs, it showed that he called this lady before he even called his own wife to tell her that her in-laws had been murdered.
And the grandparents for her child.
Correct.
With this new information about Ernie's extracurricular activities.
His dalliances.
There you go. I like that word better.
His creative writing.
Yeah. The detectives approached Ernie's wife, Robin, with details about her husband's secret life that they discovered. And this didn't just include the women and his offensive ad that he would put on Craigslist. He had a secret stash of credit cards. He had secret bank accounts, secret PO boxes, and a number of girlfriends, including one who he had apparently dated for 2 years.
Okay. You hear about these stories happening. You hear how people have, you know, separate lives, like
right.
a double life. And it's typically the man who's doing it. And I just think to myself, how do you have the energy? Like, where's your downtime, man? Like, it blows my mind that people can juggle that much
emotional energy baggage. And baggage.
Yeah. But then again, I mean, maybe it's the kind of thing that if you can do that, there's a little something wrong with you. Maybe you don't have that much emotional baggage.
Exactly.
You know,
you can turn things off too easily.
Like, it would weigh heavily on me.
But also remember, as a poker player, he was gone all the time. Like, he
that's
had,
true.
And so his dalliances never took place in Southern California. They were all in Vegas, which is where he was most of the time. Sometimes he would go to the East Coast. Sometimes he would, you know, go up to Reno, or he would just chase the poker tournaments. And every time he went there, it was a woman in every port. You know, he had all these secret accounts. He never thought he'd get caught. So he could have these meaningless flings while forgetting about the fact that he actually had a wife and child, which apparently none of these women knew about.
But I mean, like, how about the woman he dated 2 years?
She apparently never knew.
No, but
because
I mean, I know, but
she didn't live in Vegas, though.
But that's
she
not a dalliance. That's a relationship.
It is a
I don't
relationship.
Know. That's just too much energy.
But she was never in the same city. She lived on the East Coast. They would meet in Vegas.
Okay.
So he didn't even have to deal with her on a full-time basis. I bet he was busy every birthday she had. And every Christmas,
yeah.
poker tournament in, you know, Europe yeah. or yeah. South America or
well,
wherever.
You had even said that when Robin had their baby, the husband wasn't there.
He was not
Ernie
there.
Was not there.
He was at a poker tournament. He came home.
Bro was busy.
Saw the baby and quickly left the next day for another poker tournament. And, you know, the hard thing is that she can't tell him not to go because all of their lifestyle is dependent on him making cash. So
that's true. Can you imagine, like, the detectives dropped this information on her and she was like, what the what?
Exactly.
Arr, broken record. Arr.
Well, and the biggest problem she'd had, too, is I guess, like, he would be gone for such long stretches of time that she'd have bills to pay and they'd have nothing in their bank account. So she would text him and be like, hey, I got to pay these bills. We need money. And the money would always appear. Now, remember, the murders happened in March of 2008. She had actually texted her husband in February of 2008 because, again, he was gone. She never heard back from him. He comes back. They spend this little bit of time together after his parents were killed before he dips. She's texting him again. I got to make a house payment. And he never replied. And she never paid for the month of March. And here's the thing, too. And this is what didn't make a lot of sense is that according to the will, if both parents were deceased at the same time, so if one didn't predecease the other, the executor of the will would be one of the aunts. And I don't know if it was the husband's aunt or the husband's sister or the wife's sister. Different last name than both of them.
I see what
children
you're saying.
Children were not entitled to any money until they turned 30.
So basically what you're saying is, like, if the husband died first, the wife's the executor.
Exactly.
If the wife dies, the husband's. If they both die, it's the aunt.
Exactly.
Interesting.
Now, the funny thing was, though, is that Ernie wasn't yet 30. He still had 4 months until he turned 30. And so he didn't even get the cash in the first place for 4 months, right? So Catherine was in her mid-20s, you know, nobody's getting any money immediately, Ernie being the next one in line. But again, he's 4 months off. And when you're strapped for cash, that's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So according to detectives, when they called and they talked to Robin about what was going on, that's where we started way back when, they called to tell her about his secret life. She said, let me help you build your case.
Yeah.
She became another detective in the team.
Yes. A woman scorned.
Yes, exactly.
A woman scorned.
And that is the truth.
Dudes, we get really creative when we're scorned.
Yes, exactly. To the point that it amuses us.
Exactly.
Now, 3 months into Ernie Scherer's grieving cross-country trip, where he's finding all these extra women, police got a tip that he was in Las Vegas. This allowed a detective to put a GPS on his car and keep closer tabs. With this tracker, detectives did an even deeper dive into Ernie's finances, and they learned he really was strapped for cash. He had at least $90,000 in gambling debts. He had more than $40,000 in credit card debt. And of course, he had this huge payment that he owed to his parents and also a tinier payment that he owed to the seller of the house. But along with these pressures, and anybody who
lived through it in 2008,
yeah. This is when the housing market
tanked. Every market tanked.
Yes.
Everything tanked.
But in California, the housing market is normally, like, it'll go down, it doesn't tank. And it tanked. Apparently, Ernest and Charlene Scherer were putting pressure on Ernie to pay back the loan because I think, I never saw this technically, but I believe they did the 5-year loan because they were hoping within 5 years he'd be able to transfer that into an actual mortgage and then they'd get their money back.
Oh, interesting.
That was my thought.
Oh my gosh, that's right. Because they wanted him to refinance their debt. Yes.
They wanted them to refinance
that's
it.
That's right.
So they wanted their money back immediately because, as we said, remember, Ernie's dad, Ernest, was a real estate investor. And if you had the cash, there was no better time to use that money than when everybody's house was tanking and you could afford to give money.
Right.
The other thing that started with this tracker that they have, and with phone records, of course, that they're now looking at, they were able to determine that on March 7th, 2008, the day that the Scherer parents were killed, Ernie's cell phone stopped pinging in Prim, Nevada. This is in southern Nevada. It's on the border of California and Nevada, and it's the town you go through if you're heading from Vegas to Southern California. On March 7th, 2008, it stopped.
So they knew he was going from Las Vegas, heading into California, but the phone goes off in Prim. So it was 17 hours before his cell phone was turned back on. And detectives looked at that and they're like, you know what? In that 17-hour window, he absolutely could have driven north to Pleasanton and then south back to his home in Orange County. No problem.
Right. 17 hours easily.
There's a lot of time. So detectives in Alameda County, which was where the murder took place, through the course of their investigation, they basically tracked it. They're like, we are going to do exactly the route that he would have taken, because actually it's a fairly clear-cut route.
It is.
And we're going to see if we can go north to Pleasanton, south to Brea, and be home, because they know that the phone went on 17 hours later at his home in Brea. And it was almost to the minute, detective said, that they did their trip pretending to be killers.
Well, they knew when the red convertible had gone through the gates on the way home. So they went to the gates, mm-hmm. and then at that exact time, that's when they started their drive.
Right. They knew when it arrived, they knew when it left, and that's what they did. And so they basically said he had enough time to commit this murder. But detectives wanted Ernie to admit that the car in the video surveillance, the red Camaro, was his, because the video was too pixelated to specifically identify him.
Or the plate of the car.
Right. So in comes a woman scorned, the wife Robin, and she agrees to help detectives. So she wants to record a conversation with her husband, Ernie, and try to get him to make incriminating admissions.
Right.
At this point, she has not heard from her husband in weeks. And probably in her heart of hearts, she knows that she might not ever see him again.
Yeah.
You know? So she calls her husband and she says, where are you? And he says, I'm in Northern California. And then without any prompting, he says, I'm not trying to hide or anything. I'm not hiding from the cops. I mean, I didn't do this
murder.
I'm
innocent.
Yeah, but I know they're trying to collect circumstantial evidence to pin it on me, essentially. And then Robin tells him, they have you on video surveillance on the night of the murder. They have you in the country club in your red convertible. And he's stunned. It was obviously not true. And she was doing it to rattle him. And he was rattled. And Ernie said, "Can you really see the driver's face in the video?" And Robin said, "Yes." And she says, "Where were you?" And he's silent. He doesn't speak at all. So she asks him again, "Where were you that night?" And again, silence. And then he says, "What else can you tell me about the video?" And so Robin knew at that moment, with those long pauses, that her husband was a killer. And detectives who were listening in on this call knew it as well.
Nearly 1 year after the bodies of Ernest and Charlene Scherer were found in their home, their son Ernie was arrested for their murders. Ernie was confident he would not be convicted because they had no fingerprints, they had no DNA, they had no witnesses, no evidence was found in the car that they said was there that night. And I think by now he probably knew that you couldn't see the face.
Exactly.
In the car.
You couldn't ID the driver.
Right. Like we said, you couldn't even see a plate number. So they were feeling pretty confident. The defense also had talked about having solid forensic evidence. At the crime scene, they found foreign DNA in Ernest's blood, but it did not belong to Ernie. It belonged to an unknown person, which the defense said was the real killer.
And of course, the prosecutor said it was probably a first responder.
Right.
So really, the only thing the prosecution had was motive. And like OJ, he went on the lam.
Exactly. But unlike OJ, he didn't have a glove.
Right.
So he's a step ahead, man.
Exactly.
So a year after Ernie was arrested, so now 2 years then after his parents' murder, the prosecutor discovered something that changed everything. In the lead up to trial, the prosecutor was trying to find more evidence. He, of course, knew what the defense was going to say. And you always have to worry about the jury when they're like, "Oh, DNA, and it doesn't match." Mm-hmm. We're kind of, you know, DNA whores at this point. We have to have DNA
totally.
Or we don't buy it at all. The prosecutor was looking at the crime scene photos, and he noticed in the corner of one of the photos what looked like a piece of paper. So he enlarged the photo and saw that it was a warranty for a child's baseball bat. And it was a Nike youth baseball bat.
But let me just, like, a side note here.
Yes.
Like, looking at the photos, sometimes it's like, as an attorney, you see photos for so long, and then you look at them, like, truly, like, in your heart of hearts, like, I am now analyzing every square inch, and you see things that you didn't see before. And I'm sure that as the prosecution was preparing for trial, they're like, "We have nothing connecting him. I have to find something." And he probably analyzed those photos, like,
within an inch of their lives.
Exactly.
So the question, of course, is, you know, why would the Scherers need a warranty for a youth baseball bat, right? They didn't have kids who lived there. The kids were far away. Detectives were like, if Ernie is the killer, the last place we know where he was before his parents were killed was Prim, Nevada.
And where his phone went off.
Exactly. So let's take a look there and see what we can find. They checked his credit card and they found that he had bought some lunch at the McDonald's there. He had purchased gas at the Chevron right next door. And surprisingly, right next door to that was a Nike outlet store. Remember, we had said the shoe prints found in the entryway were size 12 Nikes. Police weren't lucky enough to have a credit card receipt for the Nike store. So they went there and they said, "Great, we need to see all of your receipts from March 7th, 2008. And in the midst of this, right around the same exact time that the McDonald's was being purchased and the gas was being purchased, there was a cash receipt for three items. A pair of size 12 Nikes, a youth baseball bat, same make and model, and a pair of youth soccer goalie gloves. Those were never explained. But with that information, police, of course, now are like, we got him. We can connect him to the Nike store purchasing a bat. We talked about the warranty, but a bat the size of a youth baseball bat was consistent with the blunt force trauma inflicted on Charlene and Ernest. They had never actually been able to identify exactly what it was, but this would have fit. They also were able to connect Ernie to the size 12 Nikes. Remember, shoe prints that looked like they'd almost been made intentionally. Size 12 tomahawks. There's something different about tomahawks. I can't remember what it is, but these were tomahawks that had been purchased with this cash receipt. Now, granted, they couldn't technically connect him, right? It wasn't a credit card slip or whatever.
Incredible circumstantial evidence, though.
Right.
How do you have a bloody receipt for a baseball bat, a warranty on a baseball bat at a crime scene?
Right.
Whatever he was doing there, that receipt came out of the bag. Like, I bet you anything, he pulled the bat out.
It came off the bat.
You know, something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So trial began in January of 2011. This is now almost 3 years after Ernest and Charlene were killed. The prosecution took the jury through all the things that we've mentioned, Ernie's money problems, the surveillance video with the car that may or may not have been him, his duplicitous life, dipping, that's an important one, Robin's phone call, and of course, the bloody baseball bat warranty card. His sister Catherine actually testified, as did his now ex-wife Robin and their grandpa, who was the original Ernest sharer, because he lived in South Orange County and apparently they would get together and play poker. So he testified because he saw them a few days after the parents were killed.
So the defense, of course, contended that there was no direct evidence. Everything was circumstantial. But the reality is, circumstantial evidence and direct evidence carry the same weight if the jury believes circumstantial evidence is sufficiently credible. The detectives and the prosecutors slowly built their case piece by piece. And in a shocking move, Ernie took the stand in his own defense and basically said his father was his best friend. They were both into poker. They had the same politics. Ernie loved him to bits, and he would never, ever, ever hurt his family. Ernie also talked about his seminary training in the Mormon church and the fact that he had attained Eagle Scout status in Boy Scouts. That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's painting himself as, I'm a good son. I'm an upstanding citizen. This isn't something that's in my wheelhouse. However, on cross-examination, he had to answer questions about his relationship with his mother. He had to answer questions about the indebtedness to his parents and how he was strapped and had not recently won a poker game and had unpaid bills, etc., etc., etc. And after 3 months of trial, 32-year-old Ernie Scherer was convicted on 2 counts of first-degree murder with special circumstances, which means you're going to have to serve more time for those special circumstances. And his special circumstances were multiple murders and killing for financial gain. Ernie was given 2 consecutive LWOP sentences. Yes. Kathy's favorite.
Okay, wait, actually a really quick story before we get to the end of that.
Oh, sure.
Can I just butt in?
Of course.
Brian Koberger, which we'll have an update on that, but watching some of the news coverage of it afterwards, there was a prosecutor from California who was opining on one of the shows, and he called it LWOP.
Oh.
And he's my favorite.
Okay, he gets 2 consecutive sentences, which is awesome because they're back to back, you know, and rather than running concurrently, which just doesn't count in my mind.
It doesn't.
Right. And his petition to have the California Supreme Court review the case was denied.
And this was after 2 appeals had already been rejected.
Exactly. So in closing,
Catherine said, I think my parents did an amazing job, and I don't think any kid could have asked for better parents. She also shared that her mother always pushed them to do the best that they could 100% of the time. And it wasn't that their mom was harsh or critical. She just wanted them to achieve their highest potential. Then there was an interesting story that we were talking about. Catherine had made a comment about how they always went on these big family vacations. They went to Big Sur. They went to Yosemite. They were a big nature family, or at least Catherine and her mother were, to the extent that I was able to find. And she said, you know, this was one of her mom's favorite things to do with the family. And Catherine would ask her, why do you put in all this effort and tolerate all of us just whining and complaining? And which sounds like every family vacation ever.
I swear.
Everyone.
Yeah.
And Charlene Scherer replied, because you don't understand history until you can live in it, till you can see it and touch it and experience it. Okay. Thanks for listening.
If you want to support us, hit subscribe. Thank you.
And tell your friends. All right. Apparently Kathy's done. Bye.
Bye.
A BetterHelp ad. Lewis Capaldi partnered with BetterHelp to get word out about how important therapy can be.
Or I struggle most weeks to like get up, get myself up and ready and go to therapy or, you know, whatever. Like even like to open the laptop to talk to my therapist sometimes can be really difficult. But I do it because I realise how important it is for me to continue to feel good. Because like, I felt the best I've felt in a long time through therapy.
Learn more about online therapy at betterhelp.com.